Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is an Our Paranormal Afterlife remastered episode, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. I've recently gone back and listened to some of the very first episodes, and I was reminded just how much valuable, relevant insight they still offer. So, I'm going to re-release one episode each week with updated and remastered audio for a much better listening experience. In this episode, Carla Wills Brandon talks about her book, Heavenly Hugs, Comfort, Support, and Hope from the Afterlife. Carla has been investigating spirituality and other related phenomena for over a decade. Her major radio show appearances have been dedicated to topics ranging from near-death experiences, after-death communication, deathbed visions, and premonitions. She is considered to be one of the leading researchers into deathbed visions.
Thank you for coming on to the podcast.
You're very, very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Your book, Heavenly Hugs, is sort of all about deathbed visions and that kind of thing. Can you tell us what a deathbed vision is?
A deathbed vision is something that's been around since who knows when. I'm working on another book where I'm having to do research, historical, archaeological research into this stuff. And I'm amazed to find how far back these accounts can be found. I'll give you an example. There is this rabbi, and he was getting ready to cross over to pass. And so he was laying on his deathbed. And all of a sudden, he saw his teacher and he saw his father at his bedside. Now, they had preceded him in death. That's an example of a departing vision. That's just one kind. Another kind would be the type I had with my sister who passed away a couple of months ago. I had this strange dream where she had come to me and she had her backpack on and the shoes she always wore and the cords she always wore. And she said, "Okay, I'm going to go now." I was sort of like, "Wow, you're so cocky. You know, I guess some things never change. You're invading my dreams." And then later on that afternoon, we received a call that yes, she had indeed moved on. So those are just two types of departing visions. One is for the person who is getting ready to move on, and one for the person who is at the bedside or who is a dear one or a loved one who survives. Many of us get very confused when we see this stuff or hear this stuff, because our problem is, back in the day, this was commonplace. This was not something that was unusual. It was not unusual for somebody who was getting ready to move on to look in astonishment in a corner and then say to relatives, "Do you see that? Do you see that? Do you see what I'm seeing?" And then describe visions of an afterlife. So when we got into the mechanical error, what happened, the scientific error, we stopped talking about this stuff. We decided it was superstitious. I remember my grandmother, my family on that side is from Russia. And back then, there was just a rich, rich tradition in understanding that this was just the way it was, and it was not a big deal, and nobody got their feathers rattled. That a departing vision was actually a sign that this dear one was preparing to pass. So in my work, what I do is if I'm dealing with somebody who is not doing well, when I start hearing about these sorts of experiences, or if they start doing the deathbed stare. The deathbed stare is another type of departing vision which is really misunderstood. There is a friend of mine who has a mother right now. who is preparing to pass. And it may be months, it may be weeks, it may be days. And sometimes she's here and sometimes she's not. Well, every once in a while, she'll just stop cold in her tracks and she'll start staring at a corner of the room. My grandmother did this. Stare at the corner of the room and then turn back and have a lucid conversation with the son or the granddaughter or the daughter or whoever is sitting there at the bedside. So those are just a few of the types of departing visions that I've been working with for years.
It's that classic hospital sort of scenario where somebody's lying in their bed and they start talking to somebody that we can't see. Are there ever scenarios where the people in the room can also see the spirits that are visiting?
Well, I had one account which was fantastic, in my opinion. And yes, there are those experiences. There are those experiences where the person who is preparing to move on suddenly looks towards the door and sees bright light. They'll see bright light. Or they'll see a deceased relative coming through the door. At the same time, somebody at the bedside will have the same experience. So that's not unusual. That's less reported because people just don't feel comfortable talking about this stuff. When they try to talk to the medical community about things of this nature, what happens is that either they're put on tranquilizers or their loved one is put on tranquilizers. So there's a real misunderstanding in the medical community. Thankfully, there are a few folks who have some clout who are breaking this myth. And they've done some research in nursing homes, in the VA, to show that, look, you know, these things are real and these things are happening, and to medicate is not the best idea. I remember when my mother-in-law started having these experiences. I had to take a sip of Pepsi. I remember my mother-in-law when she was passing and she began to have visions of my father-in-law, whom she called Salva. And Salva in Russian, it's a pet name. And so she started talking about how Salva is here, and she started having a conversation with him. And the hospice nurse, of all people, you would think she would have known better. The hospice nurse went running to the doctor for medication, and we had to escort her out of the room. Because basically what we told her is, look, we know how to do death. That's okay. You can leave. but she started having these experiences where she was talking to Salva. And then, but she wasn't going to go. Oh, God forbid. No. She wasn't going to go. Because she was waiting for something. And what she was waiting for actually turned up. Her mother, who died in the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Kasia showed up to take her to the other side. And once Kasia showed up, there's this huge healing that took place. It was awesome, awesome to watch. People who have trauma in their history, any type of trauma in their history, if they have a departing vision, chances are who they're waiting for is that person who might have save them from the trauma or been there for them during the trauma. That's not unusual. I mean, in this next book I'm working on specifically Holocaust survivors who have had departing visions. And I'm finding that it's not unusual for Holocaust individuals or second generation Holocaust people who are the daughters or granddaughters or great-grandchildren of Holocaust survivors will wait death is a mystery. There's a lot to it. We just don't know. But unfortunately, we think we know. We think we know. And so we think the right medication is going to take care of it. So my mother-in-law, she was not in pain. She was having a very animated conversation first with her husband and then with her mother. So in my opinion, I think that what happens in society is that we get too full of ourselves. I'm going to just be blunt. We get way too full of ourselves and we think we know it all. And so when we start hearing about afterlife contact events, a lot of us just kind of poo-poo it. You know, it's sort of like, well, that's ridiculous, or that's, you know, I am the all with all. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that, and it drives me nuts. I'm the all with all, and you don't know what you're talking about, and that could be a hallucination, and it does infuriate me. I'm sorry, I'm just not that healthy to not get infuriated, especially when it comes to the comfort that these experiences bring. These experiences are near-death experiences, except the person doesn't come back. They don't come back. What happens for them is that they really do move on. And it actually helps the person in the process of making that transition. I don't think I answered your question at all.
Oh, I just asked if there are reports of other people in the room seeing the visiting spirits, basically.
Oh, let me answer that really quick. There was a guy who I know who was with his relative who was preparing to pass. And all of a sudden, there were these, what he described as angels coming downstairs. And he was not the guy who was getting ready to pass. At the same time, his relatives saw the same thing. And there are accounts, I have tons of accounts, where people will see a departed loved one, if not by themselves, without a visitation. My husband saw his father sitting in our parlor, where we have a 100-year-old house, in our parlor after he departed. That's called an after-death communication. A woman at the facility where my father-in-law was staying also saw this individual. That's a individual experience, but combined experience, yes. And it kind of blows the poor person away who's the one who's sitting at the bedside when they do see that deceased relative at the same time that their loved one who's transitioning sees this deceased person too. So that's just one of many accounts.
And there's also a couple of accounts in your book where people see something rise from the body, some kind of vapor or mist or something.
That's my favorite topic. Okay. Way back in the day, in the Victorian times, there were these researchers, and mediumship was really something. I went to Arthur Findlay, and I'm a medium, and I have to have mentorship because my brain is my worst enemy. And so not only had I received a lot of accounts about this, but at the same time, while studying at Arthur Findlay, I read about a lot of accounts like this. I mean, they're so numerous. Previous to that, all I had were the accounts I received from people after doing a radio show like this, or letters, or people who wanted to participate in one of my books. And so previous to hearing about all of this historical data, what happened was my cousin, Yvonne, her mother escaped Eastern Europe, and she made it to the States. Otherwise, she wouldn't have survived. And she came here, and she couldn't. She was a practicing dentist, but a lot of Eastern Europeans, when they came to this country, they couldn't practice their trade, so they had to take a step down and do something else. So she was a dentist in practice, but when she came to the States, she just, you know, she was a receptionist for my uncle, who was a physician. But she got very sick very suddenly. I just loved her to pieces. I really did. And my cousin was with her at that time, and so was her husband. And as the ambulance roared up to the scene, my cousin saw a gray mist leave Auntie Renee's body. Now, my uncle did not see this, but Yvonne did, and it made an imprint on her. An imprint is, we have an experience like that, and it just sticks with us. It remains with us, no matter what anybody says. You know, we may not tell anybody about it, but we keep it close to our heart, and we know that it's something real, that it's something. So she had her experience, and then when my father-in-law was preparing to pass, both my sister and I saw a grayish sort of light around him. And my sister, she started telling my father-in-law, who was a diehard atheist, you know, ex-communist who had escaped the war and then gone back as a medic and lost a ton of family. She kept saying to him, go to the light, go to the light, go to the light. And that made him so mad. But he was also waiting for something too before he left. He was waiting for Hanukkah to move on because he knew that my sons really enjoyed that holiday. A lot of people will hold off on passing because they want to wait for a special date. Somebody else recently just did that, and I will think of it later. But he passed on a Friday the 13th after the 10 o'clock news in my husband's arms. It's not uncommon for people to wait until after an anniversary, a holiday. But needless to say, before I go wandering off into the wilderness, my father-in-law was in, I think he was in the hospital. And my husband said that he was going to go spend some quality time with him. And I said, sure, I think that's a great idea. And so when he came back, he said, you're not going to believe this. And he said, I saw swirls of pastel light leaving father's body. And I said, well, that means that he's getting ready to move on pretty soon. And at that time, as I said, I hadn't really studied these historical accounts. And what I learned when I did that was that there were all sorts of examples of almost like a pear mirror body shape floating above the body of the person who's getting ready to move on. Of the mist, a lot of accounts of the mist. But the one that was the most fascinating was the body that replicated the human body. And then it was standing by the body. There are pictures, I've got them in my other room, that artists have painted in the 1400s, where there are these examples of the spirit body leaving the physical body. Now, when you have so many of those from so many different cultures depicting the same thing, you have to go, wonder what that's about. When all these different cultures, all these different artists are putting on paint the same experience at the deathbed, it does make one go, So I love getting these accounts. I absolutely do. In one of my books, I think it's Isn't that terrible? I can't remember my books. Senior moment, crowd. Spiritually transformative experiences. I mean, in that book, I have a whole chapter devoted to the missed experience and how people can often be sitting at the bedside and see something physically leaving the body. I was in a meeting years ago, and it happened to be in an AIDS coalition building where a lot of people, it was in the late 80s, early 90s. There was the Holocaust of AIDS that was just really, really detrimental. And I was sitting there and I saw a mist float across the room. Well, a lot of people like to get woo-woo and say, well, that's a ghost and this is this and this is your imagination. I think that that was the spirit of somebody who had received help from the AIDS Coalition. Another time, this is kind of a strange story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. I don't think I've ever told it on air. We had this cat who showed up on our front porch, and she just showed up, and she was old and feeble, and she walked right into our house and made herself at home. And she had the worst yowl of any animal I've ever owned. And she got very, very sick after a few months. And so I had to put her down myself. And at the moment I put her down, my husband saw a light of some sort leaving the area of the room where I was putting her down and going out the door. So, as I said before, there is so much we don't know about death. I have a friend in Russia who has been working on measuring the size of the spirit forever and ever. And he's been poo-pooed a lot too. People have confronted him and said that, well, you know, you don't know how many liquids leave the body and the gases that leave the body and the this and the that. And he just goes on his business and does what he needs to do. So not everybody sees the mist. I'm going to be really honest about that. It seems to be something that people will see suddenly. They'll just suddenly notice it. And in the moment of the trauma, well, they'll notice it, but they won't get enthralled with it. It's not until after the event that they reflect and they go, wow, what was that? So, and as I said, the mist that I have encountered, the mist that I have documented have been pastel. They have been gray. They have been silver. They have been a variety of color, and I don't know what to say about that because I don't have the answer to that right now. Hopefully somebody or someone like me will get some information on that. I think it's just totally, totally fascinating. And it does make sense because this physical body that we are in, it's carbon and a bunch of water, basically. And so it's biological. It's very, very biological. And I'll talk to people who have lost a loved one and they won't want to go to the funeral because they don't want to see the corpse because they feel that the corpse won't represent the real person. My mother, when she passed, I remember looking into her coffin. It did not look like her at all. There was no life there. And to from the mouth of babes, I'll never forget when my son, he was 16 years old, his grandmother had died. He told me he wanted to see her body. I said, okay. And we went and took a peek and he said, yeah, that's right. Nobody's there. So he knew nobody was there. No essence, no life essence, no spirit, no soul, no person. That the vehicle that carried the soul, the spirit, was going back to Earth, and that all that was, you know, and that the spirit had vacated the body. So there's something that leaves the body. I'm very, very confident in saying that.
Another thing I read in the book that I thought was very interesting was when you went to Raymond Moody's and you had something happen to you in a psychomantium.
That was, I've been a medium all of my life. And my mother was a medium and my grandfather was a medium. And the only one who didn't get the memo was me. So I'd been having these experiences all my life, starting with my mother. And I'd wrestled with it a lot. I met Raymond in San Antonio at an IANS conference. And he is a character. That's all I can say. He really is a character. Well, he invited me and maybe four or five other people to his place in, I can't remember, in the South somewhere. He lived at that time in a mill house, an old mill house that had been transformed into a home. And it was right on a river. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful setting. And at that time, he was studying what was called the psychomantium. The psychomantium was based on the seer going into, in ancient times, the seer, the person who's the prophet, or above the prophet, going into a cave and staying there until they had a vision. And so what he did is he built these psychomantiums to kind of replicate that experience. In his house, I think he had, there was one that was made out of blankets. And when I went in there, I thought I was going to die because it was so hot. I thought I was going to suffocate. And then there was another one that he had built into his house. And then there was one that some mechanically minded person had put together for him, and it was upstairs. There may have been one more. I can't really remember. But no alcohol was allowed, no cigarettes, no drugs. We had a vegetarian meal, and he would lecture us about the history of the psychomantium, about how these people, these prophets, these seers, what would be asked to have a vision by the king or the emperor or whoever to reveal information about certain situations that would help them get through whatever trauma they were going through. And I thought it was fascinating. And his house was full of books. You know, they're stacked everywhere. And it was fun just to kind of roam around his house and sit down on a stair and just kind of pick up a book. But anyway, we all went through these psychomantiums. And after dinner, I was so tired. I really just wanted to go up and sleep. But something told me, Carla, you need to go in that one last psychomantium that was mechanically put together. Now, what these looked like were, even the one that was a blanket one, the cave that was made of blankets, that's what I like to call it. There was a mirror hung on the wall. That was it. A chair, no lights, no nothing. That was it. And it was pitch black dark in these things. And so I remember going into the one that he built into his house. And I remember just sobbing. My grandmother had passed and my grandfather wasn't looking really well. And, you know, all of that older generation, all the people who had been my anchors were moving on. And so I had been grieving for all of them. And so I went into the built-in one and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed for everybody who had been there, who was moving on. And that was very healing, but I didn't really have any experience. And then after dinner, I went into this last one, and in this last one, I sat down And I thought, okay, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens here. We'll give this a whirl. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, all of a sudden, this mist began to come out of the mirror. It poured out of the mirror. And at first, it scared me. It really scared me because I didn't know what it was. It was out of my realm of experience. It was the unknown. And so I said to myself, we are here to learn. We are here to learn. We are here to learn. And as I said that, more of the mist came out. And then now I want you to listen to me while I'm talking about this. I want you to see how imprinted this is upon me, even though this happened several decades ago. But this experience is so imprinted upon me that I can still describe it in detail. I can't describe what I got at the grocery store yesterday. But that's what happens with these experiences, is that they imprint on the brain and the emotions come back. So I began to see these orbs. The mist moved into the shape of orbs. And these orbs started circling me. The temperature inside the psychomantium dropped a little bit. And then I felt one of the orbs go through my left side in my chest heart area. And it was the most intense feeling of love I had ever had in my life. Then somebody comes along and they open up the psychomantium. They don't even knock, just open it up. And they say, how are you doing in here? I said, oh, I'm doing fine. I'm doing okay. And then they close the door. And of course, the mist had gone away, but it came right back. It came back. And so it continued to circle. The orbs continued to circle around me. And I just kind of sat there feeling, I knew it was all of my relatives who had moved on. I knew it was the spiritual essence of all of them. And that they were there to reassure me that everything was okay. And I've had this as a medium. I've had the same experience since then, but not nearly as strong as this. But then some yokel did come along, opened up the door and said, it's my turn now. You need to get out of there. And so that was the end of the experience. But I was so moved by it. I didn't know what to make of it. I didn't know what to make of it at all. And so when I got out of the apparatus, I had to go to the back and outside, and I just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. And I didn't sob because I was sad. I sobbed because it was so beautiful. It was such a beautiful experience. And that it was one that I wasn't real quick to share. I told Raymond about it, and I never put it in any books. I never talked about it publicly. I just wanted to hold on to it because it was so special and it was mine. And eventually I did put it in. What is the name of that book? Spiritually Transformative Experiences. And so that's something that I'm not asked about very often, but I can tell you for a fact that when I do start talking about it, the imprint, the emotions, the memories, the just seeing it all is so incredibly strong that it brings back the whole experience. And I'm very grateful I had it.
And was it very therapeutic?
It was therapeutic in a sense that there was a lot. I from that point on, I always knew that my relatives on the other side were there for me. Always. I've always known that. We have arguments. We have arguments. Every once in a while, I get mad. When my sister passed away, I was angry at my mother for spoiling her. So we had words. Because we have to remember that those that transition to the other side are the same people. It's not like they become angelic beings, you know, who have been hit on the head with a fairy wand. They go to the other side and the journey continues. The spiritual evolution continues. So if I'm doing a reading, it's not unusual for someone to present themselves, someone from the other side, to present themselves in their spiritual evolution on the other side. So the way I look at it today is I can't reach out and really touch them physically. But what I did learn from that experience is that they're there for sure. And so for, I've had, I almost died a couple of years ago. I had a Mercer thing in one of my knees. And so I've had to have a couple of knee replacements and some other ugly stuff. And I knew all my relatives were there. I knew every single one of them were there. And I always know when they're there. So, and yes, it was therapeutic. At that point, I recognized for sure that this is an evolution.
Do you ever get any information about reincarnation? Is that something that you believe is a reality?
I think it's a choice. That's just me. I think that some people choose to do that. I think people can also choose to be part of a spirit team. Oh, we are going off to the, we're going to wander off here a minute. A spirit team is a group of spiritual individuals on the other side who, as a part of their own evolution, choose to be of assistance to somebody who's here. And we can have thousands of these spirit people working with us. And I believe that they help us get through trauma and drama and life if we ask. They're not going to interfere with our lives because we have free will. But that is their choice. It's their choice to be in that position. And then I believe that there are others who pick up the choice of reincarnating for whatever reason. So, like I said, I think there's so much about all of this that we don't know, that we're too hoity-toity to really take a look at, that I know I have a spirit team. I have a spirit team that helps me when I'm in a bad spot, that helps me when I do readings, that helps me when, has helped me tremendously through all of these health issues. And so I think the possibilities are even more than we realize. So those are the only ones that I'm really aware of.
Getting back to your book, you talk about a book called Deathbed Visions by Sir William Barrett. Could you tell us a little bit about that book?
Okay. Sir William Barrett's book was published after his passing. And he was a physicist. I mean, he was a renowned physicist. And he was kind of like atheist. He didn't believe in anything real spiritual. And he was married to a gynecological surgeon. And so neither of them woke up one day and said, hey, we're going to go into afterlife contact. It didn't happen that way. What happened was that his wife, in her work, began to notice that the people she was treating would oftentimes say out loud, oh, there's my father standing next to the bed, or, oh, there's my mother. Back in the day, there were people who would be in the armed forces, World War I, and they would be sitting in their tents. And their loved ones, of course, would be far, far away on the other side of the world. And they would suddenly see the materialization of a sister or brother or somebody. And when they would see these materializations, they didn't know what to make of them. In one instance, there were two soldiers in a tent, and they both saw the materialization of one of the men's sister. Then months later, they would receive information about how the sister had passed. So they had seen the sister at the moment of her passing, But because they didn't have Wi-Fi or internet or cell phones, it took a while for the information to get there. And so they couldn't really talk about it openly. With this situation, this other situation, when the gynecologist would perform surgeries and these women would come close to death and they would have these experiences one after another, it was the first time they really couldn't be ignored. And so she and her husband started taking a look at the consistency from account to account. They wanted to see, okay, are these hallucinations, or is there really something going on? And so what they discovered were several things. They discovered that when a person was passing, let me just tell the story, it's easier. There was a woman who was preparing to pass, and she saw one of her really good friends / cousins. And she said, oh, look, there's, you know, so-and-so. And then she said something about her father being there, and her father, I think, had passed. Now, this cousin, friend person, had passed while this other woman was in the hospital dying. So she would not have known in any way, shape, or color, form, that her friend had passed. No way. When she was told that her friend had passed, she was shocked. She was almost shocked. And she would say, no, no, she's right over there. She's right there. And she's waving at me. And so that's an account where somebody is passing, and then they see somebody else who has passed, but they didn't know they had passed. There were a couple of presidents, U.S. presidents, who had a similar experience, and I'm not even going to name them because I'll get it wrong, where one was passing and, without being told, knew that the other one had already passed. So this couple, what they did is they collected these accounts, and they discovered that they were comforting. They discovered that children were in these visions, they didn't have angel wings. So for years and years and years, what had happened is that advertisements had put wings on people who are passing, or who are in heaven, or who are on the other side. And what they discovered is that there were no wings on these, on people in the next realm. They discovered that they looked the same as they did before they passed. So they put together this list of consistencies, and then they tried to present it at some of these, you know, back then Victorian psychic organizations, institutions, and they got ooh, you know, shoo-shoo on down the road with you a lot. They weren't taken seriously, we'll put it that way. And as I said, the book, the little book, it's a very thin little green book. I have an original copy. It was one of the first books in the modern era, if you call the Victorian age the modern era, that discussed this. Now, on down the line, there came a couple of other scientists, and one is named Haraldson. He's still living. And he and his partner decided to replicate what the folks in the first study had done. And so what they did is they put together a big survey, a huge, huge survey. You can find the survey in The Hour of Death. That's the name of the book. And so what they did is they put together this huge survey asking all these questions about what did you see as death drew near, and they passed it out to nurses and doctors and had them fill it out. And they did not call it a deathbed vision. They called it a hallucination, because they knew that if they said deathbed vision, that people would just, they would they wouldn't take the study seriously. And what they found were similarities to the first study done in 1924. So they were doing their study starting in the 50s, I think. And so what their study proved was that if an individual had a departing vision, they're a much better patient. So you could have a patient who is incredibly death phobic, and they would have one of these experiences. And then all of a sudden, they would be very, very, they would change. There would be like this radical change in them. They would be, the fear would be gone. They would feel comfortable with the concept and idea of passing. They would be more concerned with those they are going to be leaving behind. So they found a lot of characteristics that were similar to the first study. Now, since then, Peter Feinstein, who is another researcher, and he is in your neck of the woods, he did studies in nursing homes and hospitals. He hooked up with a woman who's a registered nurse in Ireland and replicated the study. And you know what? It's consistent. It's consistent. The people who come to visit are not the person that is the grocery clerk that checks out their groceries. It's not somebody they just met. It's not the person that traumatized them. I get that question all the time. I don't want to be greeted by the person who molested me or hurt me. But there is always a greeting with some spirit person or persons who have come to escort us to the other side and show us what it's going to be like over there. And it has all the characteristics of a departing vision. The only difference is that the person who has the near-death experience comes back, whereas the person who has the departing vision, they carry on and they make the transition to the other side.
That consistency across all those years, that really tells us something, doesn't it? That the people are not just, I don't know, hallucinating all sorts of crazy things.
Yes, because when I had the departing vision with my sister, and then she passed away, I think she passed away at that moment. When that sort of thing takes place, and then we find that there are other accounts that are just like that, where somebody comes to visit and they come to say, I love you, goodbye, I'll still be here, I'm sorry I have to go. You know, when that kind of stuff comes up, that's consistency. When you have a patient who's been very combative and difficult and death phobic and all of a sudden, my mother-in-law was the most death phobic person on the planet, but when she had this experience with her husband and her mother, all of a sudden she felt comforted and she was not scared anymore. And that's the biggest gift, is that there's this, the sense of fear evaporates. And it also can help with pain reduction. So you have somebody who is, they're just going through a really, really rough time. They're scared of death. They grew up in a family where people didn't talk about death. They went to church, yes, but they never talked about death in reality. Children were sequestered away from death because people thought it would hurt them to see a corpse. Just all of that stuff that has gone on in our society for the last number of decades around death. We have a whole society of people who are passing right now who grew up with that. And there was a woman who, Holocaust and what happened with the Holocaust and what people, but also people who were in Germany who didn't do anything, who had nothing to do with the Nazis, went through a lot of trauma, a lot of trauma. And scientifically researching that, And we see that their responses are exactly like that of a Holocaust survivor. So this friend of mine had had an experience like that. When the Allies came in to Germany, she was put in a camp at the age of 12. And so she had a really, really rough time. And so she was on her deathbed, and all of a sudden, she started speaking in German. Now, when people are preparing to pass, a lot of times, if they have another tongue of origin, if they're French, or if they're Italian, or if they are Russian, they will. My mother-in-law started speaking Polish, and we had to get her sister in. But they will begin to speak in a different language. And so my friend started speaking in German, and her husband said to me, "What do I do?" I said, "Talk to her in German." What we discovered was that she was having conversations with somebody about her history, her past history. It was an incredibly healing experience for her because she had been atheist all her life. So I think that the medical world has a lot to learn from these encounters when it comes to palliative care and taking care of patients.
But there's so many medical staff just dismiss it, and they say it's imagination or hallucination or something, and they want to give them drugs.
Well, they want to give them drugs. They don't care for the family very well. I haven't seen very many hospice people be attentive in these situations. Hospice comes in, and they provide the drugs for care, which is fine. I don't think anybody should have to die in massive pain, but I don't think that an overload of drugs is a good thing either. And they tried to give my mother-in-law, who had no pain whatsoever, drugs, and we told them to get out. So a lot of people, they have these events, but the sad thing is, here's the sad thing. I have another friend in Italy. And his son died, and it was a very, very sad thing. And when his son was dying, he looked out the window, and he saw some of his relatives and spirits. With lucidity, he turned to his father and told his father about this. This was incredibly healing for his father because his father, Claudio, knew where his son was going. And he knew his son would be okay. So here you have this massive healing for this entire family, which wouldn't have happened if the son was over-medicated. Does that make sense? So medication to a point to make somebody comfortable. I would not have wanted my mother to be suffering so badly with the cancer. She came to me at the moment of her passing. And she just let me know that she was moving on and that she cared for me. And that was very healing for me. What would have happened if she had been over-medicated? Totally over-medicated. There are so many things that go on at the moment of passing. And so we have people who like to, they're skeptical and they put their pen in their pocket and they want to explain all this stuff away. They drive me nuts. And Wikipedia, the only place I'm listed in Wikipedia is as a nut job by a major skeptic. That's it. That's the only place on Wikipedia. Well, this certain person, this is a person who is so death phobic. I'm not going to mention names, but so death phobic that they have come up with all these different reasons for why the departing vision is not real. And even though every single one of these explanations have been, they've been researched and dismissed, they still keep talking about, it's the dying brain. It's not the dying brain. That's been dismissed. That's been measured, quantified. It's not the dying brain. Well, it's medication, over-medication. Well, no, that's not it either. Well, it's the illness that's making it happen. And no, because research has shown that it doesn't, the illness can be different from person to person, and one can still have a deathbed or departing vision. So these guys are making a lot of money on television. Television companies love having these skeptic guys on TV. And they spout off their words of wisdom, which don't make any sense to me. And then they get paid a whole lot. So they have an investment. They have an investment in keeping these myths going. And so what happens is that you have medical students who come in and their first or second year. Trying to talk to them about departing visions is like sticking a knife in one's heart and twisting it. It's kind of like,
is it really that bad?
It's bad. It's bad. I live down the street from one of the largest medical schools in the country, and I wanted to replicate Haraldson and Osis's study. But I did. I tried to present this study, which had been replicated so many times, to the board, the palliative care board at this institution. And they basically said no. They said no. These are people who are working in the field of palliative care. And I was shocked, absolutely shocked. So, I could not do the study on my own. It would have been way too expensive. And so I felt very sad about that. But that's not uncommon. A lot of money is spent on cancer, which is, you know, cancer is a deadly disease. But I think that palliative care is, with all of the, with the boomer, a, you know, the boomers coming to a place where they're beginning to transition, and you know, how can we make this a better situation for not only them, not only their families, but for us? How can we do that? I think it's a very important task, and I don't see it. I just don't see it around here. Every once in a while, somebody will send me a dissertation on departing visions that they're, you know, doing, and they want to, an okay or something from me. And, but that's it. I mean, I just don't see huge studies outside of Peter Feinstein and a few others in the UK. And, over here, I just can't really think off the top of my head of anybody doing anything that spectacular. Outside the VA, now this is interesting. The VA picked up the baton and they decided to do research on vets who were passing. And they basically got the same results.
Well, it means something, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does mean something.
Yeah.
It means that something's going on.
We've come up to full time now.
Okay.
It's been great. I'm so glad you talk and you explain so much.
I'm glad. And if anybody has any questions, they can definitely contact me on Facebook. Just plug in Carla Wills Brandon and you will find me.
Can people get your books? They're on Amazon, aren't they?
Yeah, just go to Amazon and plug in Carla Wills Brandon. And I'll tell you the truth. I'll tell you a secret. I buy all my books back used. You can find them for a really good deal. So, you know, be sure to check out the Abe's books and some of these used book venues. And you can get a good deal. Plus, they're on Kindle. I think some of them are also on WhisperNet. So, yeah, you can find me and you can find them.
And do you have your own website?
Yes, it's www. Carla with a C, Wills, Wills, Brandon, Brandon. Oh, yeah, .com. That's right.
Okay. Thank you very much for giving us your time and explaining so much for us.
Thank you so much.
And that was an interview with Carla Wills Brandon about her book, Heavenly Hugs, Comfort, Support, and Hope from the Afterlife. A great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon, where you get access to the extended episodes. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions, and you can sign up for a 7-day free trial. Just go to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife. And don't forget my book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is on Amazon. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.